I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the Times Business Podcast, where we're taking a look ahead to some of the events that are going to be moving markets and shaping investment decisions in the coming days. I'm Robert Miller. That means asking whether we can really call an end to the financial crisis. What sort of autumn is in store for stock market investors? Will Tesla finally get its mass production Model 3 onto the roads this month? And finally, is this investment guru really the man to give you management advice?
I was kind of wild then, and it was New Year's Eve, and I got drunk, and he got drunk, and, you know, we did that. And I punched him. I didn't get fired for that.
Well, more about that later. This week, I'm joined in the studio here in London by Alexandra Freen, a business columnist at The Times, Callum Jones, our stock markets reporter, and on the line from New York, James Dean, US business editor of The Times. Welcome to you all. James, let's start with you over there in New York City. You covered the US Federal Reserve decision to hold rates, and perhaps more importantly, to begin unwinding a rather gargantuan $4.5 or $4.5 trillion asset purchase program. Just let's listen to a clip of what Janet Yellen, the Fed chairwoman, said first.
We also decided that in October, we will begin the balance sheet normalization program that we outlined in June. This program will reduce our securities holdings in a gradual and predictable manner.
James, it's been, almost 9 years now since the Fed started buying assets, and probably to save global capitalism, some people think. Do you think what Janet Yellen said really does signal the end of the financial crisis? And perhaps how is it going to work, more importantly?
I think that's an interesting one, actually. It's certainly a historic moment, and it does appear to signal the end of the financial crisis. But there's a few people worried that while it might not cause another crisis, this kind of unwinding of the huge asset purchasing program that was, you know, three phases of quantitative easing, it might actually cause some disruption of its own. So we're not yet clear exactly what's going to happen. And the Fed's starting very, very slowly. It's going to slowly try and accelerate this program over time so that there isn't too much disruption to the markets. A few people certainly are worried about it. And Janet Yellen even alluded when she was talking about it, you know, when she was talking about kicking this off in October, she alluded to the fact that the Fed would stop this process of unwinding and selling off and getting rid of parts of its balance sheet because it didn't want to disrupt markets. So if economic conditions all of a sudden deteriorated, then it would stop doing it. So the problem with this is that this has never happened before. I mean, the scale of quantitative easing, that kind of thing had never happened before, and unwinding it, you know, it has never happened before. So in terms of the effect it might have, we don't know yet. It probably won't, most people think, cause another financial crisis, but it could cause volatility, certainly. And what's also going to be interesting down the line is how other central banks around the world follow suit, because the Fed is it's the first of all of the big central banks to actually start this unwinding process.
Yeah, I agree with James. Is that I think the chances of it causing major instability are quite low. This has been telegraphed for literally years, that this unwinding of the portfolio. And even, you know, they're just going to do, I think it's like $10 billion a month, which is a very small amount from a $4.5 trillion portfolio. And still, by the end of it, they're aiming to have about $3 trillion. I mean, these are enormous sums of money. They will go slowly. Janet Yellen is so cautious. She's shown us that just at by the slow way she's moved to increase rates. And I can't believe there isn't anybody on Wall Street and in the markets that are involved with this that hasn't already drawn up plans A, B and C for what to do as the unwinding starts.
Callum, you're nodding your head there.
Well, precisely, the markets have known this is coming for some time. The main reaction we've seen over recent days has actually been to around the talk of another rate rise later this year. So you've seen some of the financials back on the rise, particularly in London. Barclays did quite well because low rates have put pressure on their margins over the past couple of years. So and we saw the other week when the Bank of England was talking about a possible rise over here as well, that banks were rising again. So that's been the main response on the markets rather than what they already knew was coming.
James, I remember 18 months, 2 years ago when the tapering was first mooted, there was the so-called taper tantrum. Any chance that they'll throw their toys out at the prime over there on Wall Street again?
Well, they haven't so far. And as Callum mentioned, this has been well telegraphed to the market, I think, certainly since June this year when the plans were first laid out and before then when the Fed started talking about this unwinding process. So the temper tantrum was really quite a sharp reaction. Obviously, this was going back to when Ben Bernanke was talking about reducing the third phase of quantitative easing. And that caused severe shocks in terms of, you know, stock market fall. Also, you know, bond yields kind of spiked at the time, caused all sorts of problems. But I think this time the Fed is fully aware of what happened back then and has been extremely careful in the way it's gone about making sure everyone in the market knows what's going to happen, and also extremely careful about doing this very, very slowly. As Alex mentioned, we're talking very small kind of figures to start off with in terms of, you know, what is a gargantuan balance sheet of $4.5 trillion that will accelerate as time goes on. But also, as Janet Yellen said, clearly she has the flexibility to stop this whenever she wants, so that there aren't any shocks to the market. So I don't think at the moment we'll see anything of that degree, but you know, you never know quite what's going
to
happen.
At the moment, I'm struggling to keep track of what President Trump has said about Janet Yellen this week. I mean, he seems to be still playing her hot and cold 8 months after the inauguration. And I just wonder if she is moved out of that job, or whether she does leave over the coming years, what that might do in terms of this program, whether that might completely change things, and we might be having a very different conversation in the not so distant future.
I think the program as laid out so far will be continued whatever happens to her at the start of next year. I think it's the end of February that her term expires. Obviously, we still do have on the table the prospect of her serving another term, kind of a bit of a surprise that President Trump gave us earlier this year when he talked about the fact that he likes low interest rates and that Janet Yellen had done a good job. Also, obviously, the other main contender and the person that most people think will get the Fed chair job in February next year is Gary Cohn, who is Mr. Trump's closest economic advisor. He was second in command to Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs before he went to the White House. So I think Mr. Cohn is fairly pragmatic. I'm fairly sure that he would have certainly had, I don't know if he had some kind of input on these plans, but he'd have certainly been able to digest these plans. We certainly haven't seen any kind of words from the White House or from him about this being a bad idea. It all seems to have gone over fairly smoothly. So I think once the plan's put in place, and if it's seen to be working and there's no shocks to markets, and there certainly haven't been so far, then yeah, I think we'll see it over time that it will it'll probably go ahead as planned, whoever's in the chair.
So, I mean, summing up briefly, James, then no reason, certainly from where you're sitting over there, for investors to be worried. I mean, apart from obviously the unexpected shocks, but everything at the moment would put the US economy on track to be growing at a reasonable rate and still offering decent investment opportunities, even though the market seemed to be at ridiculous record highs, 42nd so far this year for the Dow.
Oh, indeed, yes. I mean, the record highs, again, arguably, have been actually caused by this huge asset purchasing program and the kind of similar ones taken, similar ones put in place across by other central banks across the world. I don't think, as we've seen, there haven't been any shocks so far. There hasn't been any particular movement in the market so far. So I don't think there's anything to fear at the moment. A few people are saying, well, that's fine now, but when the program ramps up, when this balance sheet shrinking program accelerates, then maybe that's the kind of time that we will see some problems and see a bit of volatility. But there hasn't been anything to fear up until this point. And the fact that the Fed is even doing this right now is a signal that they think the economy is strong enough to withstand this program. So I think for the moment, there's not too much to worry about.
OK, well, we'll leave markets and the Fed and all matters like that alone at the moment. Let's hone down. Look at one of the very successful shares been hitting regular highs over there in the United States. Yes, it's Tesla, the electric car maker. It's due, James, I think I'm right in saying its mass production Model 3 is due on the roads this month. Are they going to make it? And I have to say, first, of course, we've got in the Elon Musk corner, we have Alexandra Freen. And you, obviously, are a bit of a sceptic, I have to say. Is that fair?
I'm certainly not a sceptic about the man Elon Musk himself. I mean, there's no way around it. The man is an extremely clever man. You could say he's a genius. He's done some incredible things. And I think I think with Tesla, he has kind of an excellent company there. But I've always been a skeptic about his lofty statements about pretty much everything and the company's lofty projections for deliveries and for kind of production generally. I mean, he's talking about making 500,000 cars a year, having never even made 100,000 cars in a year. And he's talking about doing that by next year. So by any stretch, that is, they might call it a stretch target in management speak, but I might say it's probably not an achievable one, but he may well prove me wrong. Unfortunately, his track record has shown, in terms of the track record, has shown that they're not very good at delivering cars. They're not very good at ramping up production, not very good at delivering cars on time. But who knows? I mean, the demand for the Model 3 is so high that and the amount of money that is being pumped into development at Tesla in terms of their manufacturing capability is so high. They had a recent bond issue to help finance this as well. So I'd hope to be proved wrong, because I think, you know, electric cars are fantastic and I think they are the future. But given the kind of lofty statements in the past, I'm still a bit sceptical.
I think a really interesting way that Elon Musk has managed demand surrounding this his first mass-produced car. The demand is phenomenal. You know, the waiting list is more than a year. I've just come back from New York. I was staying with friends who are sitting there waiting. They're prepared to wait another 14 months for their car to be delivered. And the reason they're having to wait 14 months for theirs is because they're not getting the high end. So the people who buy the $49,000 version get their cars first. And then if you buy the $43,000 or the whatever the lower one is, you get your car later. And it's almost a cult-like following amongst these early adopters of Teslas. They're so happy to wait for their car to come. And Musk is making car manufacturing is a really low margin business. He's clearing easily $15,000 of margin on each of these cars. I accept he's not been very good at delivering on his promises and delivery numbers. But once he gets going, I really think that he could get there eventually. He's got to show us that he can do it. But I think there's a very high chance that he will.
It's one of those stocks which just it doesn't matter who you speak to, everyone seems to have an opinion of it. And obviously, let's not forget, it's had a rapid rise over the past, I think it's 7 years since its IPO. It floated at $17. Now it's, I think last time, over 370. So massive, massive rise. It's a company which there's a lot of excitement about on Wall Street and in the city here, but also goes back to what James was saying about Elon Musk. He's a man who's followed by people well outside the city as well, who people hang off his every word. So there's certainly a heck of a lot of excitement about this company. Whether it can deliver on the substance, of course, is the key question here.
And just on this whole issue of electric cars, I would recommend everybody out there to read a column that our colleague Robin Pagnamenta has written about the market for electric cars. It's absolutely fascinating take, looking at the market for secondhand electric cars and how it's actually hampered by the fact that the batteries, the lithium batteries, sort of lose shelf life with time. And it means that the value of secondhand cars is much, much less proportionately than it would be for a diesel or a normal petrol car. And that's holding back growth of this market. It's full of really interesting facts like that. And I think it does remind those enthusiast like myself that would like to see this electric car market expand really rapidly, that it's actually going to be a very slow expansion.
But reason to hope then, James, over their final thought on it, Tesla is in some ways going to deliver on its promise then, in part.
Yeah, no, of course it has. No, because a few people have test driven them. So reaction so far has been very positive, as you'd expect. I haven't driven a Model 3 myself, but I have driven the kind of the saloon car, which was the more expensive. It was the more expensive P100D. And, you know, within about half an hour of driving it, I thought to myself, why on earth isn't everyone driving an electric car? This thing is putting out no pollution on the streets I'm driving on. It was a wonderful drive. The help with the self-driving technology on it as well, in terms of the lane-changing technology on the motorway, in terms of, you know, the self-parking facility, even just down to the fact that it was just a nice interior in the car. I mean, these are great, they're great products. You know, the iPhone is a great product. That's why everyone buys them. And it's, you know, it may well be that the Model 3 is of that kind of standard. You know, it is the iPhone of electric cars. But it remains to be seen. I mean, I think they'll probably get likely to have production issues as they ramp up production to this huge goal of 500,000 a year. But I'm still quite excited to try one, to be honest.
Goodness me. Dreams are shattered. I thought he was a boy racer. He's not now. He's fully converted.
They're fast, those cars.
They're really fast,
yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
I think it's 0 to 60 miles an hour. And the fastest ones go 0 to 60 miles an hour in just over 3 seconds when you've got the ludicrous speed mode enabled, which is faster than many, you know, 100,000, 200,000 pound sports cars.
Well, it's me that needs to be converted. Clearly, I'll go on a course. There must be one about it.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
All right, finally, let's have a bit of fun. Alexandra, you've been looking at a book, Principles, by Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater Associates. I've been reading he's the most successful hedge fund manager ever. He recently, sat down with Henry Blodgett on Business Insider. And it was his voice you heard at the top of the podcast. Here's another clip.
I think it's important. I know that the key to my success has not been so much what I know as much as how I deal with my not knowing. I mean, that's basically a big theme of the book. How do you have an idea meritocracy? There are only two things that you need to do in order to be successful. The first is you have to know what the right decisions to make are. And then you have to have the courage to make them.
That was Ray Dalio there with Henry Blodgett on the Business Insider website. Alex, I've perhaps been a little bit selective with the Ray Dalio clips, but just explain why he should strike a chord with investors.
Well, Ray Dalio is an extraordinary man. He's very unusual. Bridgewater Associates, his hedge fund, operates almost like a cult. It has its own way sort of groupthink that all the employees are obliged to follow, and they get kicked out if they don't. It goes under this name of radical truth or radical transparency. And it means that you are expected to share your very blunt assessments of your colleagues' behaviour and their performance, their personality, what they say to them, to their face, all the time, on an ongoing basis. And if you don't do that, you get in trouble. And if you're not very open about anything you do, you will get sort of hauled up in front of your bosses and questioned. There was one very famous case when one employee had lied about typing an email versus actually dictating it. And she got dressed down, you know, in front of the whole staff. There is this sort of homework that they have to do. They have to rate their colleagues on 75 different attributes 15 times a week. And these generate baseball cards where everyone's given a score. So Ray Dalio thinks this is how you do business. He thinks this is how you run your workplace. He has a very high turnover because not everyone can hack it. He's currently the subject of a couple of lawsuits from former employees who say they've been browbeaten. And he also has this other thing called, it's a ritual they call public hangings, and they don't actually
it's worse.
They don't actually hang people, but they take, you know, members of staff to task in front of their colleagues. So it's odd. And interestingly, what Ray Dalio has done, these are his principles, and he's now published them in a book that's available for everyone who wants to immerse themselves in this cult-like behaviour. So you can buy it. It's published by Simon & Schuster out this week. It's called Principles by Ray Dalio. And frankly, I wouldn't waste your money on it because I think it's just bonkers way to run a business. He has been very successful in the past. He's lost.
You have to say that, though, don't you? I mean, at the end of the day, we'd be saying he is bonkers and it sounds awful. But on the other hand, he is hugely successful.
Well, he is, although recently he has been much less successful recently.
There is a flaw then.
And also, I'm sorry, but making money isn't the only point of companies. They're there to create jobs, to keep the wheels of society turning. They're not just there to screw people and make their employees miserable. That's a very odd way to look at the world.
I assume also by publishing this book and by going through the process of writing down all these rules and releasing them into the public domain, he's trying to claim that the culture at this company is also the secret or the driver behind its success. Is there any proof behind that?
Well, he would say, yes, there is. For many years, he was the most successful hedge fund. So, yes, he would say truth. I mean, he's always had them written down. They were in a book that you had to sort of virtually memorize if you worked there. It's just that only now is it being sort of published in a form for the general public. And not only that, but he's developed some apps now. There's something called the Dot Collector, which is an app which employees can use to rate each other on their phones, and something called the Pain Button, where you can record emotions like anger or frustration. And I guess, I don't know, maybe that gets shared with your colleagues as well. I think he's just trying to make more money, frankly, and get a bit more. He loves the attention. He absolutely loves the attention.
Right, on that very happy note, thank you all. And don't forget, watch out for financial updates. There's a large number of stock market mid-sized companies reporting in the next few days. Ferro Petroleum and Tissue Regenex, a great deal of biotech companies, I notice. There's that, and of course, all the other news and analysis you can find online, phones, tablets, and in the paper. And if you'd like to become a subscriber and aren't already, then sign up at thetimes.co.uk. And then you'll also receive our daily morning and lunchtime business bulletins, well worth having. If you want to hear us weekly, just subscribe through iTunes. My thanks to Alexandra Freen and Callum James in the studio. Let's give them all top scores. And James Dean over there in New York. Jury's out, I'm afraid, James. They are on Twitter, though, so you can keep up to date with the story. Do follow them. And please join us again next week. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.